Hi, it's Judy. This is the third and final episode of my thesis podcast, Listening to Fire Knowledges in and around the Okanagan Valley. In making this episode about cultural burning and prescribed burning, I'd like to start with a special thanks to Joe Gilchrist and John Davies for inviting me to attend and learn from their spring burns. I've shared some resources for those interested in learning more about living well with fire in the Okanagan on my thesis website, which is listeningtofirepodcast.ca. I hope you enjoy this last episode. Thanks for listening.
I think that ecologically, if I had one thing for you to take away, it's to remember that even when we burn a landscape or a landscape receives fire, it's not always going to be all black, forever, nuclear devastation. There is a lot of vegetation that responds very quickly, immediately after a fire, especially when the ground is black and there's seeds under the soil. And maybe there's communities that have experienced catastrophic fire, and that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the lighter footprint of fire moving across the landscape, not coming into our community. My name is Sonia, and I live in Fort Nelson, which is in northern British Columbia, one of the most remote communities in our province, just below the Northwest Territories. And I own two companies, Shifting Mosaics Consulting, which is an ecological consulting company, and Northern Fireworks, which is a specialized fire company. And I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta in the Wildfire Analytics Lab. I'm a registered professional forester and a professional agrologist and a registered professional biologist in British Columbia. And I have a PhD from Oklahoma State. Go Cowboys! And I've chosen to live in Fort Nelson for the last 16 years, or perhaps it has chosen me to be here. I was born in Lethbridge, Alberta. My parents had a very large ranch beside the Head Smashed In Buffalo Jump, right in the middle of many different reservations in southern Alberta. And we had a cow-calf operation, beef cattle. And when I got old enough to go to school, we moved to the East Kootenays of British Columbia, where we had another couple of ranches, and we had a large range tenure, which is crown land leased from the government for our cattle. And we ran our beef operation there with over 1,000 head of cows and calves. In 1985, we had just moved over to the East Kootenays, to the Windermere Valley in 1984, and to one of the historic ranches, the Elkhorn Ranch. And in 1985, this little five-year-old at 6 o'clock in the morning in the summertime, and a first time I'd ever heard a helicopter, and it landed in one of our hay fields next to the cabin my parents and I were living in at the time. And the Forest Service told us that a huge wildfire had broken out in the middle of our range tenure where our cows were. It's the first time that our cattle had experienced mountains, and it's definitely the first time our cows had experienced fire. And then the Forest Service asked if they could use our ranch, the Elkhorn Ranch, as the base camp for the whole fire operation that summer up the Findlay Creek and Fir Mountain. I remember the things that I remember from then are my parents going out and trying to get our cows to go across creeks and work with the Forest Service, and helicopters constantly landing and taking off from our haystack every day, and it was really dusty and really smoky in the Windermere Valley that whole summer. And I remember looking up and seeing chunks of ash falling. I didn't know at the time that the people that were staying on our ranch and fighting that fire were people that I was going to work with later in my career. I also, when I look back onto it, growing up next to the Head Smashed In Buffalo Jump in southern Alberta, it's a really monumental experience as well, to grow up in a place, in a land that bison roamed. And in a very roundabout way, I find myself in my professional career with bison and wildlife and cattle and fire and wildfire and prescribed fire.
Sonia Leverkus runs her two businesses, Shifting Mosaics Consulting and Northern Fireworks in Fort Nelson. I wanted to talk to her because her research on fire ecology and her practices of prescribed burning have important implications for the Okanagan Valley. Prescribed burns are fires lit purposefully by credentialed fire experts after a detailed burn plan has been made and approved. They can be used for many purposes, including reducing wildfire hazards on the land and burning fire-maintained landscapes for ecological benefits. Although they can have similar benefits, prescribed burns are different from cultural burns, which are conducted by indigenous knowledge keepers as a cultural and spiritual practice. You'll hear more about prescribed burning and cultural burning in this episode.
I'm a ranch kid, so grasslands are one of my favorite ecosystems. I love the boreal and our boreal rangeland for sure up here. I think that when I think about the Okanagan and when I watch up here on the satellites, watching where fire is spreading and has spread this past year in the fire season, it really makes me want to help or provide support to apply fire to that landscape in times where it's under a prescription instead of a wildfire ignition starts and it's a state of emergency. And so one of the concepts that I developed in my PhD was this thought around fire absorbent landscapes. And I think when I think about grasslands, we can apply fire in a grassland setting and keep it within a certain prescribed fire unit. And it doesn't need to be extensively complicated unless we're right up against communities or lots of values at risk. Even then, we can plan and apply fire to that landscape in a very, very safe way under certain indices and prescriptions. So I think the application of fire can happen anywhere, and I would definitely see the Okanagan as being a great place for that, with a rich history, as you noted, traditional and by ranchers and the cattlemen and cattlewomen of BC. And then I also think about fire absorbent landscapes, where we can put fire in a good place so that when a wildfire comes, we can pull that wildfire into these fire absorbent landscapes. So it's almost like a sponge. I feel like when you have wording around fire that is accepting, and I feel like when we talk about fire absorbent landscapes, where we can allow fire to move into places that we have already pre-planned or pre-burned for other landscape objectives or reasons, I feel like that's a really important thing to think about. And so when I was in my PhD, we developed a management system called the Landscape Disturbance Matrix. And basically it's a matrix that talks about having places that have been recently burned, that have not been burned for some time, that haven't been burned for a really long time. And then that also supports all these different species across a landscape. And so I think that the Okanagan is a good place for that.
In Sonia's description of her work, I hear echoes of the story that Nancy Turner shared with us in the first episode from an Okanagan elder.
It's like creating different patches at different successional stages all over the territory of people.
So ecologically, I think that these are important discussions, but then culturally, I think it's important for us to recognize that Indigenous people have been lighting fire for centuries, and that non-Indigenous people have also been lighting fires. And so I speak to that, that I do see opportunity for a really amazing interaction between Indigenous knowledge holders and Indigenous communities and ranchers that used to use fire and people that used to use fire and now trying to incorporate it with various different governments and other fire professionals. I also think that Okanagan is a great place to show people and teach people about fire, because there are so many people across the landscape doing demonstration prescribed fire, doing trials. I think that would be really beneficial. And I think that that cultural, that human interaction of putting fire on the land is very, very important. And I think that It needs to be better recognized, especially as people in our province talk a lot about the importance of it, but we see this significant decline in the approval of prescribed fire from the BC government and in the tightening up of what is expected in order to put fire back on the land. And so I think that a lot of people can talk the talk, but there's only a handful of us that are willing to really walk the walk and fight the fight. And I think that there needs to be many of us being voices for fire, provincially, nationally, internationally.
Yeah, could you say your name for the...
David Lynn. I'm the fire chief for the city of Vernon.
Awesome. Yeah, what's going on? Tell me what we're seeing right now.
Well, so the fellows with the drip torches are lighting some of the underbrush. And so there's some hardwoods in there. And so this land has had fire excluded from it for quite some time. So we've done some cleanup, some mechanical thinning. And now they're applying a prescribed burn. So they're applying fire under the right conditions to return the land to a more natural state. So it's reducing the fire risk. It's actually healthy for the land and the habitat. This land should have fire on it from time to time. And so we're getting a good effect. We're probably about a week too late as far as optimum burn, but we're still having a good effect and we're reducing the risk that for the rest of the season.
Yeah, it's like I'm looking across and I'm seeing the fire and then I'm seeing like these houses right up against this brush filled area. And is that like one of the reasons this site was chosen, because it's right up against these properties that could be really in danger from like a big wildfire event?
Absolutely. And so this land that we're on right now belongs to the city of Vernon. And in the city, we've been making efforts to try and have everyone around us take part in reducing their fuel loads, doing fire smart activities and those kinds of things. So we're recognizing that as a city, we have a responsibility to take care of the lands that we own. This specific site, as you mentioned, has the homes backing right onto a gully, a ravine, the response area is about 10 minutes away from our closest fire hall. So if we were to have a fire in this area in August with the fuel loads remaining on the land, there's a good chance that it could spread to a home or multiple homes. So it's really a preventative maintenance kind of strategy.
I'm with John Davies looking at fire and smoke from this prescribed burn. John, what are we seeing happen right now?
So we're in a small draw behind people's homes in foothills in Vernon, and we're in a fairly open conifer stand. It's got a lot of shrubbery beneath it, but also a lot of needle litter. And behind people's homes, we had hose lay in place, and we've started blacklining at the top. So we're just starting to put more torches on it now and get it done. And then we have Rider Ventures, which is an Aboriginal company based out of Vernon here. And they have 20 people out here, of which I believe 18 are Métis or First Nations. Yeah, multi-agency, multiple companies out here putting fire on the landscape.
Yeah. It's awesome.
I agree.
Actually, a lot of smoke columns around today, it seems like. Is this like kind of normal?
It's a good burning day. For the Okanagan, and that can be a rarity with the venting index requirements that the regional district or the province puts in place. It probably would have burnt through here every, you know, maybe 6-10 years to 30-40 years. And so you can imagine how many fires have been missed in the Silver Star BX foothills area, and just how much more fuel there is here than would have been historical. And that is a problem right across all throughout BC.
Those were recordings from April 2022, from the first prescribed burn that I attended in the Okanagan. I was excited to attend. This is what needs to be happening, I thought. Why is it so hard to get these light spring fires going, I wondered, to take care for the spaces around our homes and the landscapes beyond them? I keep wondering. this episode takes us deeper into conversations about applying fire to the landscape. You'll hear more about the promise of cultural burning and prescribed burning, and some of the challenges to making good fire happen. I met John Davies about a month earlier when I interviewed him for this podcast at the Frontline Operations Group office in Vernon. He is a registered professional forester who co-founded Frontline Operations Group, a company specializing in wildland fire management.
Yeah, can you talk more about what's distinctive about fire in the Okanagan Valley?
Yeah, I think it differs in the sense of, say, something up in the boreal, because up there, the fuel types are primarily, you know, dense white spruce, black spruce, muskeg type fuels. Whereas in the Okanagan, you know, a lot of the times at the valley bottom, you're dealing with grasses, grassland fuels, and something starts in someone's backyard or a roadside accident or a cigarette on the road. It gets into grass, moves really quickly, and then it's, if there's a treed slope above, then it moves into some heavier timber and you get into heavier fuels. And then the other aspect is that there's just a lot of interface. So there's a lot of structural, human-made values in the Okanagan Valley bottom. I think we're also blessed in the sense that, you know, we have a lot of lakes, right? We have lakes in the Okanagan from north to south, so we usually have pretty good access to water when we do have that valley bottom proximal fire. And so that really helps. And I think the other challenging part of it is just, we just don't always have the access to get to where we need to go because of private land or no roads or steep terrain.
It was after I started firefighting. So I started firefighting in 93 and I started my forestry degree in 94. And so 94 was a really busy year. And at the end of that summer, I ended up going back to Ontario to fight fire. And I got a message when I phoned home that I had received a letter. So that I'd been accepted at UBC. And so I managed to pick up my courses and stuff while I was on the fire line and register for those. And then I think within 3 days of leaving Ontario, I'd flown back, driven back to Thunder Bay, flown back to Kamloops, driven to Salmon Arm, packed all my stuff up on a Sunday night and driven down to UBC, slept in my truck and went to my first calculus class Monday morning at 8:30.
Wow.
And that was how I started forestry.
With calculus. Do they teach you how to burn in forestry school?
No.
Okay.
They didn't when I went. There was one class, there was one semester, 3 credits that was focused on fire. And then in ecology, there was one chapter in a book that was focused on fire. It's a forgotten part of forestry, which is unfortunate because it's an integral part of our ecosystems. That might be changed now where they have more fire focus, and I believe that it is.
Even in the past few decades, since a positive conception of fire has come back into favor in forest management, putting fire back onto the land has been extremely challenging.
There have been a lot of films that talk about forest fire prevention or about fighting fires. This film talks about lighting fires.
This is a short film about prescribed fire in BC that was produced by the Ministry of Forests and aired on the first season of the television series Westland in 1984. Don't want it.
Wildfires must be controlled as always, but foresters and other resource managers are learning that prescribed fire can be a useful tool in the management of many public resources.
Among professional resource managers, there is now almost total agreement that if we are going to practice good forest management, or silviculture, if we are going to maintain good winter ranges for wildlife, if we want to control forest succession onto grasslands, then we will have to have more fire.
Not every intentional use of fire is the same. For example, throughout much of the 20th century, the timber industry has used permitted, controlled burns to get rid of slash or timber debris before the hot, dry summer wildfire season makes that debris a hazard. These burns were used to prevent valuable timber from burning up in wildfires. So some forms of controlled burning have been used by the BC Wildfire Service alongside fire suppression tactics, while other forms of intentional burning, like spring and fall cultural burns that cultivated a biodiverse landscape, greatly decreased in use. It's also important to point out that slash burning and other forms of prescribed burning have been decreasing in BC for the past 30 years, despite alarm bells ringing about the need for more intentional fuel management, including prescribed fire, and the ecological, cultural, and wildfire risk reduction benefits that adding cool burns to the land can bring, it's getting harder to burn instead of easier. When it was more common in the 70s and 80s, controlled burning did serve a teaching role for foresters. For most of the foresters I talked to, using fire wasn't something that they learned in school, but something that they grew comfortable with after fighting fires or conducting prescribed burns. Sonia described the way that fire can be used to sustain ecosystem health and support livestock. I asked a number of my interviewees more about the current practices of managing fire-prone landscapes in the dry forests of the southern interior, where fire has been excluded for so long.
Can you tell me more about the projects that you're working on in the Okanagan, like some of the prescribed burns and fuel treatments?
So we've actually had a couple landscape-level fuel breaks that were tested by wildfires. One was in 2020 in the Mount Christie fire up at Heritage Hills. And the second one was at West Shore Estates on Westside Road this year on the White Rock Lake fire. So we've been lucky that way in the sense that we've been able to go out to a site that's been, you know, needed to have something done, figured out what needed to be done, prescribed it, implemented it, and then actually had it tested to show the results. So that's interesting to be able to walk into a stand and see the fire effects.
Yeah. How did it look?
Both of them were successful, and talking to the fire professionals on site, the fire departments, there was a noticeable change in fire behavior, which is great. That's the whole idea. Heritage Hills, that fire came through, burnt a good chunk of the canopy, but then dropped down on the ground before it got to the homes. And then similarly in West Shore Estates, it just went through a corner of it, never actually went towards the structures, but hopefully, you know, that was maybe a result of running out of fuel. And so fire will always follow the fuel. Yeah, you can walk through the stand, you can see what the fire did, how it changed. When I think back to the early 90s when I started, like the first interface fire that I remember was the Garnet fire in Penticton, 94. And then, there were then a red truck showed up on our base, and we had to learn to, it was basically a small fire truck. Now we were going to we're going to start going out and protecting homes and not just fighting fires and trees. And then, so through that career, it started to become more common to have interface fires, even though they probably had always happened, just more rare. And certainly since, since Kelowna in 2003 and a few other, all the other interface fires that happened that year, it became more at the forefront. And then there's just been a ton of fires since then that have been interface and destroyed communities, including this year. We're pushing development further out into wildlands. People are spending more time out, so you have more potential for human risk. We stopped burning as part of fire management / burning and whatnot in the 80s. So, we're 40, 60 years of built up fuel. We mentioned earlier about, how planting dense stands of, lodgepole pine and whatever else that we planted, 80 or 100 years ago are now mature stands that have been impacted by mountain pine beetle. We have, these huge tracts of continuous fuel. And so I think, we're at that point where we're paying for it. It's frustrating to me as a resident, as a taxpayer, as a fire professional, as a forester, because we need to stop building homes that burn down, for one. So that starts at the developer and local government planning department level. And that's all real basic fire smart stuff. That's just building materials, landscaping materials, and treatments around the development to protect it. That is stuff that's all handled at a local government level. So that's a city or municipalities, planning department, putting in some very specific development guidelines and then standing up to them. So a lot of local governments now are moving towards developing wildfire development permit areas, within which if a developer or a homeowner wants to do something on a property, they have to have a wildfire risk assessment done, same as they would have an environmental report done or a hillside stability report done. And so when I see these developments or individual homes pushing up a hillside into the grasslands or the forests, and their cedar shake roofs, or their landscaping appropriately with cedar hedges and juniper bushes and vegetation right up to the home, one way in, one way out, I just shake my head. It's just, you know, it's just a matter of time. And you can see those old developments scattered all down the Okanagan, where you can point out, well, that's gonna burn eventually. I look across the lake every day at a hillside. It's just a matter of time. You know, there are little developments that are on big lots. They're one way in, one way out. There's root rot all over the hillside, so all the Douglas fir is dying and falling down and creating a fuel hazard. It's full of recreational trails. It's on a west aspect. It's got a road at the bottom of it susceptible to human-caused ignition. So really, it's the perfect storm, and it just needs to the spark.
You know, after my biology degree, I could tell you more about what the inside of a plant looked like than what the actual plant was called or what its uses may be. But it was definitely my work and my career as a naturalist and a park interpreter that helped me develop my current understanding of fire ecology. Wendy Pope, area supervisor of the South Okanagan BC Parks. And I also use she, her pronouns. And I also feel incredibly fortunate to live as well as to work and most importantly to play in the traditional territory of the Silk people. It's absolutely a beautiful landscape where I find myself. So I'm very grateful. I've got a wildfire risk reduction project, and in government we're calling these WRR. We've got to abbreviate everything because we use too many words. Wildfire Risk Reduction Project. Personally, I haven't dipped my toes into these kinds of projects yet, but actually in the Okanagan office, we have got another area supervisor has just transferred over from BC Wildfire. And he brings a tremendous amount of expertise. And so he's been just really going blazes on no pun intended. He's just been going great blazes on these WRR projects. And so I suppose I've been influenced by just kind of watching what he's doing. But in my own little area, Fintry, there's Fintry Provincial Park, and then there's to the west of it, there's a much larger Fintry Protected Area. And at the south end of that protected area, there are a couple of communities. There's Upper Fintry and there's also La Casa. And these communities are the urban interface. They're butted right up against the forest. They are probably less than a kilometer south of the White Rock Lake wildfire of last year, of 2021.
Wendy explained that BC Parks has been working with the community in La Casa to manage the impacts of ATV use around the park area. For Wendy, proposing a fuel treatment project that would reduce the risk of wildfires reaching the community was a way to continue building that relationship and goodwill, while also supporting the fire-maintained ecosystems in the park.
So this year, I put in a pretty general proposal for this area behind La Casa and said, you know, on top of it, ticking the boxes of urban interface, ecological restoration, for me, it actually helps tick a box of building relationship with a community that we are asking for a change of behavior from. And I think that's really key.
I also reached out to Wendy because I wanted to talk about the relationship between land conservation and fire management in the Okanagan. Many scholars have written about the way parks in North America were created with a particular settler colonial conservation mindset, in which landscapes that we care most about should be cordoned off and left alone, rather than actively managed by people. This cultural story fails to engage with our Okanagan landscapes as places where Silk Okanagan people have lived with and actively cared for the land with fire for millennia. Wendy and I had a great conversation about this.
Yeah, moving away from the idea of do the parks need to be protected from the people, I guess the key in that idea is who are the people? Are they the people who have cared for and really loved and lived in harmony with the land for so long. No, those are not the people that we're protecting the parks from. We're protecting the parks from, you know, basically from the colonial mindset, the entitled, consumptive, selfish relationship that a lot of people unfortunately have had fostered in them, just because of the culture and the time that we now find ourselves in. Have I seen a shift over my time? I guess I have. I was actually speaking with my supervisor, Mark Weston, this morning and saying, you know, I don't personally have the longevity with this agency to speak to that. What have you seen in the South Okanagan? And he actually told me about, he said back in 2007, Mahoney Ecological Reserve, which is, I guess it's closer to the closest to the town of Okanagan Falls. But back in 2007, there was some, I don't know what to call it. I think it was some type of prescribed burning that happened. And there was definitely engagement with the Lower Similkameen and Indian Band at the time. And of course, 2007 was right around the time that UNDRIP was adopted. I know at that time there was a growing awareness and a push to involve and engage First Nations partners. And apparently that project went quite well. Since then, I think the process has become, it's hard to describe. I think the process has basically become more complex, and you're going to get different answers depending on who you ask. But in my humble opinion, it just feels less meaningful. I have a feeling that back in 2007, there was a push to engage First Nations partners, and it was a relatively organic process. Now, in 2022, we find ourselves in this very scripted, very precisely prescribed paper exchange where we send referral letters and we are supposed to send them on every single thing that we do. It's totally overwhelming to both governments. It's way easier to talk about than it is to implement the type of involvement and the type of collaboration that I think most of us really, really do yearn for. You know, when you look at the history, there's obviously a tremendous and understandable amount of distrust by Indigenous communities of government. And one of the main problems is that we are trying to build that relationship and build that trust, but we're doing it within the context of these really high pressure situations. You know, we as government employees, we tend to come to the consultative table with a set of objectives, and we are looking to our First Nations partners for a yes or a no, because that's all we really have time to, just give me a yes or a no. And instead of coming with a bunch of objectives, why aren't we coming to the table with a bunch of questions? You know, what do you feel are the priorities? How would you like to see this park managed? Instead of government coming to First Nations communities and saying, we want approval to do the things that we've identified as important, why aren't we asking First Nations partners what they feel is important? We really need some added capacity to build the relationship, because without that, we are just coming to the table with an emergency and a set of solutions. And I just don't think that makes for the most meaningful relationship building between governments. Until we have capacity funding to actually enable First Nations to contribute their time, you know, towards this referral process, and also allows them to live in capitalist 2022 North America, you know, and pay the bills, I think it's we're more just kind of going through the motions. Yeah, it's really difficult to ask for something and offer nothing in return. Kind of fast forwarding from 2007, where we did a pretty successful burn project in Mahoney Lake with some good engagement from local Indigenous communities. This year, there's going to be some burning happening at Conkle Lake. They're working really closely with Indigenous partners to roll that one out. So that's certainly very encouraging.
You know, my career up to working with West Bank has mainly been in industry and a bit of time with government. And I tell you, when I started here with West Bank, my whole paradigm on forest management went through a huge shift. I was like, felt like I was standing on my head half the time, not really understanding, like, this isn't the way that I was told or taught on how to do things. It's not the way that I've been doing things my whole career. And everything has shifted. But there came a point where I was in the forest one day and walking through it and trying to determine whether or not we should log this area or not, and how to, if we were, and some of the values. And it kind of hit me in a strange sort of way. It might sound a little bit, a little bit crazy, but, it kind of came together for me that here I am on unceded land, unceded territory. I'm making decisions on land that I don't own, land that has been cared for by the Silk people for thousands of years. What gives me the right to be making this decision? And what are the implications of that decision? And how long will the implications of that decision last? And I thought about that for a while and I didn't make any decision. I came back to the office and...
That was Dave Gill, who you heard from in the last episode, about managing the West Bank Community Forest. Community forests are a form of land tenure in British Columbia where a specific parcel of land is managed by a local government, community group, or First Nation. Dave and I talked a lot about the challenges of managing a landscape while keeping multiple values in mind. Deciding to manage the land to reduce wildfire risk to properties, to protect the watershed, to support old growth, to generate timber income, to revitalize cultural burning practices, or for a few of those values at a time, those are intentional decisions that are rarely uncontentious. Dave talked about the process of managing the West Bank Community Forest, with West Bank First Nation values at the forefront.
We do have regular meetings through the ONA Forestry Working Group, and there are elders and knowledge keepers that are often on these calls. And just listening to what they have to say and the responsibility that they still see they have on caring for the land, and looking through every decision through a seven-generation lens, that what will be there for your grandkids or great-grandkids, and understanding that the values that are on the land may change, but sometimes that's not a bad thing. Sometimes that's a good thing. So understanding and envisioning in your head what you would like to see here 120 years from now. We started our wildfire mitigation program even before I started. We did a project back in 2011, I believe. And then since that time, we've been actively doing it just about every year since 2013. The areas that we've focused on have been up in the West Kelowna area, Upper Glen Rosa community, some areas around Rose Valley. And we're busy. We're actually doing some right now on West Bank First Nation land. It's work that is very difficult, but at the same time, it's quite rewarding, especially with the Mount Law fire that came through this past summer. And just hearing from the fire chief that when that fire hit the area that we treated, he said his crew said the roar went out of the fire. So it shows you that this work, it's expensive and it's tough, but it is effective. And, you know, there's a lot of talk of cultural burns, and that's an awesome way to manage this in the long term. But because we've, you know, been hitting fires hard for the last 100 years, we've got an incredible buildup of fuel in the forest. And to get back to the cultural burns is going to take a little bit of work. And some of that work is this mitigation work. And once we do the mitigation work, it, cultural fires, I believe, can be conducted and should be conducted in many of these areas where we've removed a lot of the fuel. The funding is never enough to do what needs to be done. We have so much that we could be doing. And I'm talking about managing for fire, at, not just on the interface, the urban interface, but out on the landscape as well. And I don't think that, despite the fact that fire is a natural event here, I don't think there's a lot of people that really would say, yeah, it's okay for 30,000 hectares to burn here and, you know, 40,000 over there. I just don't think we're there anymore. There's infrastructure all over the place. There are values that, that people hold dear all over the place. We're going to have to manage fire, and we're not going to be able to let fire run like perhaps it did historically. We're in a significant time of change, as you've probably seen and heard on the news. And I do believe we're at a point in time where more decisions about the forest have to be driven by local communities. The decisions for good forest management don't come out of Victoria. They come out of the local community. They come out of First Nation knowledge keepers. They come from people who have been on the land, whether they're Indigenous or not, for years, who understand the land and can see what's going on and what's happening and you know, give a heads up when they see something that isn't right. And that's a huge shift. That is a shift that we haven't seen in this province. It's always been driven from the top. And I really see that, depending on where you are in the province, the focus on fire management will be playing a huge role in how we are managing forests around communities. We've seen too much devastation over the past couple decades. That's always going to be fresh in people's minds. And they're going to be looking at these community, local tenures to be protecting their communities and to be using fire or to be managing for fire to ensure that they are protected.
So I'm Amy. I'm a Métis woman from Treaty 8 territory. My family's the Cardinal and Labakan families, which are two pretty prominent families, Métis families from the Fort McMurray and Owl River areas. I grew up in a little town called Whitecourt, Alberta, which is in Treaty 8, and I live now in Treaty 6 territory in a little town called Rocky Mountain House. I'm also a research scientist with the Canadian Forest Service, where all my work is kind of on Indigenous fire. So looking at evacuations and return of fire to the land, cultural burning. And just basically I do a lot of more national level work on supporting Indigenous peoples in returning fire.
Amy Cardinal Christensen's work and research has been important for understanding the social aspects of living with fire. As she said here, much of her work has focused on Indigenous fire management. It's included understanding the promise of cultural burning and obstacles to it, the disproportionate impacts wildfires pose to First Nations communities, and the experiences of Indigenous people working in wildland firefighting. She's also the co-host of the Good Fire podcast. She made a lot of connections for me between national and global conversations about fire and local needs for changes in fire management and response.
You know, anytime it seems like Western nations are kind of faced with these big, bad fire events that, you know, people start looking for other solutions. So we saw that in Australia, in like California, we're seeing that now in Canada, where, you know, there's been some really bad summers where millions of people have been impacted, not only by fire, but by smoke for like a long time. Like we didn't have hardly any fires last year in Alberta, but we were smoked out for like a month from the BC fires. And so, you know, it really can impact people a far ways away. One of the big swings that I've seen is even just in my career, like I've been with the Canadian Forest Service 10 years, the first 5 years, nobody talked about Indigenous people or cultural fire. Part of that was like our federal government at the time, which was like the Stephen Harper conservative era. But yeah, I'd say in the last 5 years, we've seen a real like swing or attention to this area. And so that's been really exciting. Of course, for many Indigenous people, it's never like it's not fast enough. Like for me, I'm always frustrated. But when I like sit and think back, you know, 5-10 years ago, what it was like when I first started my career, there has been big changes. I think another really big thing that I've seen is just the focus on prevention and mitigation in Canada. So, you know, we have the Fire Smart program in Canada that started in the 1990s in Alberta, but it really saw limited attention for a lot of years, despite amazing people really trying to push, you know, push Fire Smart and Fire Smart activities. But, you know, in the last, again, 5 to 10 years, it's really become a national program and more agencies are really picking it up. So that's exciting. Like we just had that UN report come out that I was a co-author on that showed that like, I think it was 99.8% of international spending is on fire suppression and 0.2% is on mitigation and prevention of wildfire. And so, you know, that's something that we really need to see shift. Like I think in Canada, we do spend a bit more on mitigation and prevention, but we still see like, you know, the vast majority of funding going to fire suppression campaigns. So I think that that's something that people are really noticing, that we just kind of can't keep up with this anymore. You know, in my current role and just seeing like the increasing impact every year on Indigenous communities, the Canadian Forest Service, we're a research agency. We're not a fire like response or management agency. So for me, usually my role is always like media or, you know, trying to give advice or things to government operation centers that are running things. And so, yeah, usually what happens is, you know, the communities start getting evacuated, all the calls and concerns start happening. And it's just then you're just worried like the whole summer for all these communities. And it's just so frustrating, I think, seeing the same things over and over again. And I heard that this summer in a lot of the interviews with different chiefs and other First Nation evacuees, it's like, you know, when are we going to do something different? Like they're just so frustrated and tired of being repeatedly evacuated from some of these events.
Yeah, it was really scary to see the fires this summer in BC, and like so tragic to see Lytton being impacted, burned out the way it was. I'm like torn between like asking more about like some of these common problems that come up and between just asking like what feels hopeful. I don't know, which of those would you rather speak to, or both, just to wrap us up? Like what are these things that like anyone who's listening to this interview maybe should be aware of that chiefs continue to say in these like evacuation circumstances? And like, are there any like ideas and important like notes to end on for action items that we should kind of be pushing our communities to take?
Sure. So I think, you know, every summer we're just seeing just a frustration from the communities that I'm working with is just that basically they're not allowed in the fire management equation. Like, you know what I mean? They're lots of times have to get evacuated and are kind of forced out of their communities, even though they feel like they have the local knowledge. And we've seen like Chief Joel Fons with the Silcateen and other nations that have said, you know, we're not evacuating, like we're going to make our own decisions here and based on our local knowledge. And I think, yeah, like Eskeechusin was another one this summer that did that as well. So the one thing, like, although there's a lot of, you know, many issues, many frustrations on trying to get cultural fire back, on trying to get Indigenous people more involved in fire management, for me, there's also a lot of hope in it, because I think that there's just so many nations now that I see that are just standing up and, you know, saying that, you know, in either in media or, you know, privately and other things, that they want to take more of a role in fire stewardship and bringing fire back to the land, which I think is really exciting. And I think that many too, you know, aren't going to take no for an answer. You know, they're determined to be able to do this and put in place kind of any to lobby basically for any policy or regulation or, you know, certification or things that they need to be done to do that. So Whereas, you know, a few years ago, there was only a few of us kind of working or interested in this file. There's a lot more people now and a lot of really good allies, too, that have come forward to support the work. I think, too, there's been a lot of recent studies that have just come out on how Indigenous people, you know, steward biodiversity and also can provide like nature-based climate change adaptation solutions. And some of those are through the use of good fire in our territories. And so I think, like, although, you know, sometimes it's frustrating that we shouldn't need Western science, like people should just listen to our elders and what they're saying. You know, sometimes like the colonial governments rely on the more Western science to make decisions. But I think in that way, like there are changes afoot that I think to get Indigenous people kind of back and more involved in fire. And in BC as well, you know, we're seeing there that they're constantly talking about prescribed and cultural fire now. Like it's always kind of used there as well. How that will look in reality, you know, I think everyone's still trying to figure it out, but definitely like, I think that there are signs for hope. The work that I always, and Pierre is part of that group, is the Interior Salish Fire Keepers organization. I mean, the work that they're doing. So Harry Spahan and his partner Jennifer Morrison are leading that, and Joe Gilchrist is on that team too. And for me, that is like the exciting thing, and that's where we should be, you know, with local Indigenous people kind of leading. The thing I think that they and many other Indigenous groups are really confined by is, you know, the inability to access or burn on any crown land. So where most of the, you know, any cultural burning or anything that they can do has to be on reserve, especially in BC. Like, you know, you've got like the reserves basically down in the valley, right? Because they didn't want to give any of the timber to the nation that's on the slopes. But really that's where the fire risk is coming from, right? But they're unable to burn or do any sort of management in that area. One thing that people often don't understand with fire is that they kind of think like, well, it's just burning, or, you know, it's just fire. But for Indigenous communities, it's more than fire, right? It's about relationship with the land and about that role that we have with Creator to be stewards. And I think that, you know, as we're trying to get more and more fire on the ground, it's also just about that reconnection and like reclaiming territory. And so in the end, it kind of comes down to almost land back and Indigenous like autonomy and sovereignty over our lands. It's like not as simple as just saying like, hey, yeah, you can go burn over there. But it's saying like, if we let you burn over there, what does that mean, you know, for, you know, who owns what and who makes decisions over what? But like, at least we're starting to have those conversations.
As I've conducted this research, and as I've spoken with people who know fire, it continually strikes me both how much 100 years of settler colonial management has shaped Okanagan ecosystems, and how little one century seems against the millennia across which fire has helped form the entwined natures and cultures of this place. Fire has shaped this place, and it's not going anywhere. With climate change bringing hotter and drier conditions, more large fire seasons are expected. But there are many good ideas and practices circulating about how to live more consciously in community with fire in this valley. We are living in a fire culture very different than a culture of comfort with a mosaic of burning that existed before 1850. Experts agree that some form of fire suppression needs to continue, and we need to support the wildland firefighters and other first responders engaged in that work. But we can also listen to the lessons from firekeepers and practitioners of newer forms of light burning for ecological health. And we can practice more active land care in this place with an awareness that it is home to fire too.
The other challenges is, of course, the government itself and the, you know, not being allowed to burn, and the criminality that comes along with burning on off the reserve, you know, and even on the reserve now, it's getting harder because now they're, of course, everybody owns their little piece of land and their house and stuff like that. And some people are afraid of fire and don't want fire. And then So there's, you know, it's like a, it's almost a 50-50 split of people that want fire and don't want fire, and that see fire control as a way of life now, rather than fire management.
Joe Gilchrist again.
To get people back comfortable with fire, you know, and to be able to spread it onto traditional land, which is now Crown land, you know, it's a battle.
Yeah, like when you're talking to people who don't know a lot about First Nations fire stewardship and burning practices, to folks who are just used to that fire control mentality, like, what do you say? Like, what are some of those hopeful things that you want to convey to people who, like, are just like, put the fires out and that's it?
Yeah. I was doing a burn one time, and I was burning with the fire chief on the Indian reserve, and we were burning for wood ticks around the school. And we did that burn, and he decided he wanted to do, we had time to do another burn, which was the hillside near their Indian reserve. And so I said, yeah, okay, you know, there's a shale there. We could use that shale. And then just did a little guard across this part right here. And I started to burn it, and I was coming down, and then it's getting to the point where we were just, I had it's called the black line. I had the black line built across the top, and I was layering it down the hill. And of course, that makes the black line bigger. Every layer makes the black line thicker, right? And so then I was able to go to the bottom and just light it up and let it run to the top, because it's going to hit that black line and go out. And as the fire was climbing the hill, there was one tree on that hill, and the elder came running to me, and he says, I don't want that tree to burn. I, you know, it wasn't even a mature tree. It was only 30, 40 years old, maybe. And it was like maybe 16 feet tall or something like that. And it had some rose bushes and stuff underneath it. And I told him, he wanted me to go and put the fire out before the fire got there. And I said, there's no time for me to go up there and put the fire out before I said, it's going to burn around there in about 30 seconds. And you get up there and you put that out, you make sure that doesn't burn and all that kind of stuff. And this guy is like an elder, my elder, right? And, you know, you don't question, and you don't, you listen to what an elder says, right? So I told him, just watch. I said, the actual flame height from the ground is only maybe 50 centimeters, right? So I told him it's gonna burn around that tree, but it's not going to kill it. And it's only going to make the bottom one or 2 feet of that tree black. And so we sat there and we watched the fire go around it, and the way the wind was blowing and everything up the hill, it didn't kill the tree, and the bark saved the tree, which is what it's supposed to do. And, you know, he was happy, right, at the same time. And I told him, and we got to talk about, you know, the wood ticks and the mice and all this kind of stuff, that it was taken care of, killing all the wood ticks. And I told him, you know, in 2-3 weeks, when the rain comes, I said, that's going to be a really super green color, and everything else will be all yellow because it's not burnt. But that area where it's burned now is going to be green. And sure enough, you know, that's exactly what happened.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a hopeful story. Thank you.
In this episode, you heard parts of my interviews with Sonia Leverkus, John Davies, David Lind, Dave Gill, Wendy Pope, Amy Cardinal Christensen, and Joe Gilchrist. We discussed the many faces of fire, wildfires, cultural burning, and prescribed fire, and we considered how to reduce wildfire risk while balancing multiple values on the fire-prone landscapes in the Okanagan and BC. These are difficult questions, and they continue. I have a lot of people to thank. I'd like to thank everyone who I interviewed for this project. I'd also like to thank everyone who gave me background information, feedback, or advice throughout this research process, including the archivists at the Greater Vernon Museum and Archives, the Oliver Archives, the Enderby Archives, the Armstrong Archives, UBC Special Collections on both campuses, and the BC Archives. I would like to thank my committee members, Heather Latimer and Tim Paulson, for their guidance and support. And I would like to thank my supervisors, Kara Shearer and Greg Garrard, who have helped and encouraged me through the delights and challenges of this project. I couldn't have created this without you. I'd like to thank the communities of scholars who have supported me at UBCO, including the Interdisciplinary Graduate Studies Program and the Digital Arts and Humanities theme that empowered me to do this research in this audible format, my mentors and peers in the AMP Lab, the Spoken Web podcast team, especially the mentorship of Stacey Copeland and Hannah McGregor, our community of fire scholars in the Living with Wildfire Project, the Early Career Scholars Wildfire Discussion Group based in forestry at UBC Vancouver, and the Feminist Environmental Humanities Thought Leadership of the Field Lab. I'd like to thank other mentors who have stuck with me and listened to me through so many projects. Doug Bird, John Christensen, Jared Aldern, Ron Good. It's meant so much to me to continue to share ideas with you. I'd like to thank my family and friends who have shown me incredible love and support through the past 2 years, especially my parents, Jean Marie and Peter Burr, my Aunt Judy Geruso, my sisters, Jessica, Joanna, and Jenna, and my closest friends who have been just a phone call away during this time of intensive learning in a new place, River, Sarah, Verania, Chloe, Jody, Zandra, Jessica, Lindsay, Fallon, Donnie, and others. Thanks, Verania, for gifting me my first audio recorder that I still use and have been using for this project, and for believing in my podcast ideas. Thank you, too, to all the new friends I've made in and around Kelowna. I appreciate every hike, every collage, every game of pool, every drag show, every dinner. You can listen to many of the full interviews from this project on my thesis project website, listeningtofirepodcast.ca, and you can find transcripts of those interviews there. My transcripts of each of these podcast episodes include citations for my research. This research was supported in part by the Government of Canada's New Frontiers in Research Fund through UBC Okanagan's Living with Wildfire Project. Another reminder that you can take important steps today to prepare your home base and protect yourself from wildfires. Find out more at the Fire Smart Canada website. And keep an eye out for ways to support or even start organizations that care about good fire and fire ecology in your community. I'm Judy Burr, and thanks for listening.